But today is the last day we can hear Senate bills. We can hold the first public hearing on Senate bills. So we have quite a few on this list. I will be moving people very rapidly today. If you have a 2 or 3 page statement that you would like to present to us, then give a copy of that to our clerk. And if you would highlight it, please do not read the entire statement. Just highlight it for us. We'll have the documents. We get it here. In fact, in most cases, we're skimming, and we probably will get through it about the time you finish, too. So that will move things a bit more rapidly. In a couple of cases, you might wonder what we're doing. I will do we refer to it as a tap-tap almost. I will open a public hearing and almost close it simultaneously, and I get it on the record. It's an official hearing, and then next week I can deal with it. But if we don't get it done, get through this today, any item is dead. So if you'll understand what we're trying to do and understand our process, I thought it might be a little bit helpful to you. Because it will look as if I'm rushing you, and then you'll say, my gosh, how can they have a public hearing? And he bangs the gavel and bangs it quickly. That's the official, gets it in the record, and then we can hear it at a later time. So with that announcement for you, I'm going to start on the call a public hearing on Senate Bill 1285. Would you tell us about the bill and see if we have testimony?
Chair Duncan, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1285 would require criminal records checks for animal control officers. It requires training of animal control officers and requires counties to maintain records of animal impoundments by the name of the owner and keeper. This was brought to you at the request of Tom Suckle.
Yes, Mr. Suckle, yes. Would you please give it to the clerk and... Good afternoon. If you would identify yourself for the record.
Yes, my name is Thomas Buckles.
Oh, you've got to speak into that, okay.
My name is Thomas Buckles. I'm a hairdresser. Not all I could do is give you a bad haircut. But in order to do that, apparently I had to attend the school, and I had to put in 2,500 hours that were credited by the state, and also I paid for this with a year in Vietnam and out of my pocket. I appreciate the opportunity to testify on behalf of Senate Bill 1285. I'll cut a lot of this out of here.
If you could keep it to about 5-6 minutes.
Okay, well, my main concerns are it is my understanding that the ORS laws are not currently taught in the curriculum at the public safety training facility at Western Oregon State College. After determining that I was not connected with anyone, as in private citizens, the Police Academy of Portland was not open to a conversation on this issue. ORS Chapter 167, which is a state would be like entering private property and taking dogs or animal abuse or whatever, contains Class C felonies, Class A misdemeanors, and the need for search warrants. A little story about myself. The reason I'm here today is because in 1991, one animal patrol officer, two Portland police, and a Multnomah County sheriff removed my dog. Most of the animal control officers did all the work, and the sheriff and the police just sat there and watched. The note was left at my house basically stated that my dog had been rescued and taken to the veterinarian. The note also said that if I didn't act within 144 hours, my dog would be destroyed. I called the Multnomah Animal Control, and they verified that my animal would be destroyed and also read the officer's incident report over the phone to me. When I arrived at the Multnomah County Animal Control to redeem my dog, I was told that I would have to get a better attitude or I wouldn't get my dog back. On my second attempt to redeem my dog, I begged for my dog's life. Officer Larry Crabb came out of the room and helped me get my dog back. I'd like to thank him for that. What they did at my house was called an emergency animal rescue. This emergency animal rescue violates state law, county charter, and county ordinances. What is an emergency animal rescue? Well, Multnomah County is pretty much taking care of my complaints about it. Basically, no search warrants are obtained, and the dog is faces death after 144 hours. The letter I wrote, I sent to the Sheriff's Department, and every police department was in Multnomah County. The letter asked two questions. Had the department ever helped MCAC, Multnomah Animal Control, to obtain a search warrant when removing animals from private property, and what were the policies and procedures did the police department have to implement ORS 167? The only response I received was from Chief Bernie Gusto of Gresham. Apparently, the Multnomah County Sheriff and the Chief of, from Portland, Fairview, and Troutdale did not feel this matter was important enough to their citizens to warrant a response. Chief Bernie Gusto's response was, to my knowledge, Portland, the Gresham Police, has never entered private premises, either with or without a search warrant, with the Multnomah Animal Control Division to investigate either animal abuse or neglect under the state code or violations under the county ordinance.
Tom, can you kind of go direct to what highlight what the bill includes now? What?
Well, the bill is basically just to have the need for search warrants and a need for training and a need for them to keep records.
If you want search warrants, you want a search warrant, you want the people.
Have you ever called a record for a search warrant?
No.
First of all, you have to know the address. It makes it very difficult.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's like thousands of search warrants, you know. When I asked about search warrants, I could find nobody that was willing to say that they've ever gotten a search warrant in the past 13 or 14 years. The problem is they investigate like 1,300 cases a year of animal abuse. That's a lot of cases and no search warrants.
Okay, so you're after a search warrant. You want the dog control, animal control officer to be trained.
Trained to some extent. If you turn back here, you'll see some photographs here. Somewhere. There's a photograph here. This is my dog run right here.
Mm-hmm.
The officer in a sworn affidavit stated that he observed no water and the kennel had been in direct sunlight all day and the kennel had not air for circulation. Now, I don't know how you could possibly say that a chain link fence wouldn't have air circulation.
Okay, Tom, what I want to sort of deal with the bill because I can't.
Yes, sir. Well, I'm getting to that point right now. Okay. I have a letter from Mr. When he went to court, he testified that the dog was not in direct sunlight. But when you get over here, a letter from the director of the Multnomah Animal Control, Mr. Flagler, he states Officer Rowley apparently did not feel it was crucial for his case against you to indicate whether your dog's kennel was in direct sunlight or not. Now, is this the way animal control officers are trained? This man would be doing the training. It says the report did contain the veterinarian statement. No, it didn't. The statement was that the dog was both alert and responsive. If you read the officer's report, you would believe that the dog was in heat distress. So my complaint with him was that the officers should be a little more truthful in the report. And his excuse would be they didn't have any training. State law exempts these people from having training. All they have to have is experience. Well, I don't want them to have experience in my yard anymore.
Okay. Well, let me move. I'm going to ask, why don't you stay right there. Henry Miggins, are you here? Why don't you come forward, too? I see you have signed up as a witness, and you are in favor of the bill, as I understand it, okay?
Yes.
Mr. Miggins, would you
say that? Mr. Miggins, Director of Animal Control, Multnomah County. We are in favor of the bill, and in the essence of time, let me just say that we do get such once, and we have had one in the last year and a half. It's run through the Sheriff's Department, Multnomah County, and the District Attorney's Office. We are in favor of this bill because it provides education and training for our officers, make them better qualified and professional organizations to perform the tasks that they assign. Additionally, by having these officers qualified and trained, it assists the law enforcement agencies with whom we work and having confidence in the work that our officers do. We currently have training programs in place. I have three people currently working at Multnomah County Animal Control who are certified to teach EPSC type training. And because of the essence of time, I'll just leave it at that point and say we are in favor of it, as well as the Oregon Association of Animal Control.
Okay, thank you very much. Would you, you'll stay around until we finish this, okay? Diane Middle, would you please come forward?
Thank you, Chair Duncan, members of the committee. I'm Diane Middle, the Director of the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. And as you can tell, I've not taken any particular position on this show, but I want to bring a few things to your attention. I admire the request for training, and I am very pleased that they would select our agency for that training. My only concern is that this bill does not have any funding attached to it. You knew I was going to say that. I have a feeling. As you're well aware, we at this point in time do not have adequate funding or facilities to meet our current mandated needs. We're supposed to be training law enforcement officers at 16 weeks. We're only doing 10. We should not take on any additional responsibilities at this time. In order to take on a new program, like we have done in the past, it requires the board to do a job task analysis to determine what the necessary knowledge, skills, and ability are for a particular field, then to develop a curriculum that is certifiable and can be passed on. Part of what certification means is that we're prepared to testify in court that people have been trained to a certain standard and that they've met that standard. That doesn't happen just routinely. It takes a great deal of work, and it would take a great deal of staff as well to keep track of who is trained and who is not and who's done their follow-up education. So this is a bill that would need some funding attached to it, and without that, I would request to go to Ways and Means for that consideration.
Right. It definitely would. I understand that part. We would have to get a fiscal impact. Yes, Tom.
Can I say something?
Yes.
I believe every time somebody goes to court that they are assessed a penalty that is paid to the school for training.
Yes.
Let me answer that. The Department of Public Safety Standards and Training is funded, the law enforcement portion of it is funded by the criminal fines and assessment of the unitary assessment. That is the entire budget. That is the budget that is lacking adequate funds to do the law enforcement training at this point in time. We do have a budget note which is directing this agency, Department of Administrative Services, and others to try and locate additional funding to meet our needs. At this point in time, it's not there.
Sorry, because I understand you said you really want 16 weeks of training. You're only able to do...
You're actually mandated to teach 16 weeks for law enforcement. We only have the facilities and the financing to do 10.
To do 10.
So we are short 6 weeks right now.
Okay. All right. I'm going to ask Lieutenant Covey to come forward.
Thank you, Senator Duncan.
Thank you very much. Good.
Some of my presentation. I do want to point out, however,
Lieutenant, would you please identify yourself?
Yes, sir. Lieutenant Randall B. Covey with the Law Enforcement Division of the Oregon Humane Society. I'm commissioned by the governor of Oregon specifically to enforce the state animal welfare laws. The state of Oregon. Essentially, the thing that I wanted to point out is that, indicated I put it in writing, and I would encourage you to, when, as you get time to review that, that does highlight some of our position in support of Senate Bill 1285. In response to the questions about funding, it is correct, as our understanding as well, that the fines and assessments that are result from criminal violations and other violations that occur in relation to animal crimes do get put into the public safety training fund. It's our position that over the decades that animal control has been in existence and has been contributing to that fund, there has not been any benefit received in regards to training. I understand that there is a shortfall and that the police officers don't have adequate training. However, it's our position that the training required and the training that we're requesting in this bill is not the 10 to 16 weeks that the police officers are required. We believe that a basic animal control training can be provided in 1 to 2 weeks that will provide a standardized basic training for animal control officers that will help to avoid situations such as Mr. Buckholz ran into a number of years ago. The Oregon Animal Control Council has put a lot of work into developing a curriculum. As Mr. Miggins indicated, we have put officers through the BPSSG Methods of Instruction training program so that we have instructors available to provide the training. I would submit to you that the cost of the state would be minimal. The professional organization of animal control officers is willing to provide the instructors the time and the resources to provide the training. And
saying that this could be done outside the
yes, sir.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
You do it on your own.
We have had a good working relationship in the past with BPSST, and although I don't think we've had contact with with Diane herself, it is something that is evident today that that would be very workable in order to put our goal of providing training that is sponsored by the state, that is standardized, together with the offices and the administration of BPFST, and I think come out with something that is at very minimal cost and yet extremely beneficial to the state of Oregon.
Okay. Thank you very much. I think we'll let it go. Let you folks have burning questions? Okay, I'm going to move on. Okay, thank you very much. Andy, is it Lane?
Lane.
Oh, yes, it's me. I'm sorry. It's Lane. Good afternoon.
Thank you very much.
Please identify yourself for the record.
My name is Andy Lane. I'm an animal control officer from Medford, Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
I'm also the president of the Oregon Animal Control Association.
You're welcome.
And I'm also on the training committee that we have. This bill seems to me like no question. Animal control officers definitely do need the training. You need to be standardized, like in Mr. Buffalo's situation. Maybe a lot of liability could have been worked out otherwise. We deal with everything, almost every situation that law enforcement deal with, but yet we don't get any training. I started there 20 years ago, and when I started the job, they handed me my clipboard and said, what you're going to learn, you'll learn in the first few days you're out there. And from then, I've been winging it ever since. Now I'm on the training committee, and I see a great need for the officers to have the standardized training to cut down liability for officer safety. We're constantly working with the public. It's not the sort of image that animal control had from many, many years ago. Now animal control has worked out to be more of a mediating skill instead of a force enforcement. So just the importance of the training, I'm totally in support of, and I'd like to see all the officers in the state of Oregon receive the same training they deserve to have to do the job they need to do.
We don't. Excuse us, we just raised a question with regard to the fiscal aspect of whether we want. What I was just thinking here, I'm seeing a lot of people signed up for the bill, are concerned about financing it through the Board of Public Safety. I'm almost tempted, and I was just curious how you folks might feel if I just suggested that the people are here, because you represent various parts of the state and different ones. I'm almost ready to send you off to the coffee shop in some place and say, is there something you folks can work out? You know,
BPFST.
Well, I was, you know, Lieutenant Covey says you have the mechanism to do this without going through the Board on Public Safety Standards and Training, and maybe that could be done for minimal cost. And I was just wondering if I sent you out and say, hey, go back and take a look. Do you have some ideas of some amendments?
Well, what we'd like to do is see it state mandated that it's a requirement.
No, I'm not talking about that. I'm just talking about how to do it.
Oh.
Yeah. But since this concern that there could be a major fiscal impact if you send it to the Board on Public Safety Standards. You send it to Ways and Means, dealing with that, look at their problem, you probably never see it again. You probably never see the bill again. If you guys could go out and work something out, come back with a suggestion, and we get something out of the book, we might be able to do something for you. Well, let me think. I have two more people who want to testify, and let's see what they say. John Adair, would you please come forward? Good afternoon. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Senator Duncan, Senator, my name is John Adair. I'm the director of the Lane County Dog Control in the Albany area. I'm also committee chairman of the OACC, which is Oregon Animal Control Council, and the Legislative Committee. I do have written testimony I've submitted to the committee. What I'd like to do, though, basically, is just touch on a few things that I've heard now. When we talk about funding for something such as this. I think there's a little bit of confusion as to what funding from animal control goes to DPSST, because in the years that I have worked animal control since 1978, all citations that we do issue, those have a amount of fees taken and sent to DPSST. Unfortunately, our status for animal control in the state of Oregon is the fact that we're not able to go to the academy or to use any of their training facilities or their curriculum. What Oregon Animal Control Council has done, which I've attached to my statement here, is a curriculum that has been worked out. We are in the process of teaching that curriculum, but unfortunately it's not a state-certified curriculum. It's not a mandated situation.
Okay, so you currently, all of your officers in Linn County, for example, go through this program?
Yes, sir, they do.
And you do that on your own?
Yes, sir. It comes out of my training funds that I have set aside in my budget.
Mm-hmm. And you're seeking, and you'd like to see a state requirement for everyone?
Yes, I would.
And you'd like to tap into the Board of Public Safety Standards?
Yes.
Okay.
The reason why is because, you know, in animal control, It's like Andy Lane just testified, when people start out in our field, they really have no training. They're given a copy of what laws are, a key to a vehicle, and said, go out and do your thing. Animal control over the years has become a professional type job.
And, sure, all the laws.
It's also a liability job.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, in my department alone, in the past 5 years, I've had lawsuits probably numbering to the total of 6 to 7 lawsuits against my department, against myself, and against my officers. Fortunately, we have not lost any of those yet because of my officers being in-house trained and knowing what they need to do on those issues. But that doesn't set aside the fact that there's other animal control agencies in the state of Oregon that do not have that type of training. Linn County Dog Control is basically a small to medium-sized operation. We have a lot of one- and two-man operations throughout the state.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Jeff, for bringing this for us.
Thank you, Kevin.
Beth Rogers Duncan.
Yes.
Sorry to put a Duncan on last.
Don't
do that to people.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
And your daughter.
My name is Beth Vargas Duncan. I have with me today, since it is Bring Your Daughter to Work Day, Sarah Duncan.
Oh, Sarah, welcome. Glad to have you with us.
And I will be extremely brief. I already did submit a letter on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities and the Association of Counties, Oregon Counties. And our main concern with this, if you were to send us away and have us go speak in another room, I think we would end up with the same problem that we have now, that there simply is not funding for the training. And if local government were the ones to have to come up with the funding, we already, I believe, some of our programs, so we haven't done a survey of these, I don't have accurate knowledge, so with that caveat, I'm pretty certain that there are some programs that are funded through general funds of the local government. They're not entirely self-sufficient. And so this would likewise be an unfunded mandate, or very well could be an unfunded mandate on local government. And that therein lies our greatest concern with this proposition. So I'd be happy to answer any questions.
I would like to, how many people in the room are here for this particular bill, 1285? How many are here? Okay. Well, may I... Committee, try this. I'm going to suggest that the people involved right now, because we're not going to work session today on this anyhow. If you'd like to go to my office, the third floor, go back in the corner in there and talk this thing out. If you come up with something, if you have any ideas to get back to us, do so. If not, probably what will happen, the bill will either die here, or we'll send it to Ways and Means, and your chances of seeing the bill again are not very good. Okay. It sounds to me as if there's interest in doing something out there, and if you can pull it together yourselves and come back with an idea for us, at least I'd be willing, from the committee standpoint, to at least look at it. Is that fair enough, Mr. Vice Chair?
Yeah, thanks, Matt.
Yes. Yeah, my staff is up there, and you just talk to them, okay? And we'll get word to them to be prepared.
Right there.
My staff is right there, and they'll join you. 01 Would you raise your hand so they can see her? Owen, follow Owen, and you go back up, and you can use my office, and don't bite at each other, please. So try to work something out. Tom, I think you hit on an issue, at least, that's interesting.
I do have one more question.
Okay. Gotta be quick, because I got 13 bills.
Okay, well, my concern is that somebody gets trained in this matter, whether it's state police, yeah, Portland police, or somebody, and they're not trained at the academy there in it. So how do I go about doing that?
I lay that on the table with the group. So you can go with the group since it's your bill. Okay?
Thank you.
All right. Okay.
And thank
right.
you very much.
You bet, folks. Thank you very much. I'm going to close the hearing on 1285. Okay. 1285. I'm now going to open a public hearing on Senate Concurrent Resolution Number 9. Mm-hmm. Chris Damiano.
Good bill should pass.
Yes. It's a quick one.
Do I need to talk?
You can talk.
Okay.
Identify yourself there.
My name is Chris Damiano, and I'm here on actually behalf of Larry Hermo. Yeah, that's okay.
Yes.
Say that.
And where do you work?
And I work, I'm a slave to Vern Duncan.
Okay.
And I'm here on release. He's let me off the weekend.
All right.
I'm trying to take a couple minutes here. I just, Larry Hermo requested that I read this in committee, and so bear with me, I'll read this whole paper. As a former educator, it is always rewarding to hear of the successes of my former students. Once in a while, we have accomplishments that go above the norm, such as the case of Scott Brocious. Scott was a good high school baseball player, but was not highly recruited by any colleges. On a whim, I asked him if he wouldn't mind going to a small school, such as Winfield College in McMinnville. Scott agreed. He set his goals to hopefully play Major League Baseball. These goals included working hard and doing his best in everything he did. And after growing a couple of inches and working diligently, he signed his first pro contract as a junior in college at Linfield. And his Major League career has now spanned 7 years. His 1998 season was his breakout season, in which he played with the New York Yankees, went to the World Series, won the MVP of the World Series, and has made all of Oregonian and sports fans in Oregon very proud of them. That's all I have to say. Thank you very much. I appreciate the honor of speaking in front of you.
Thank you very much. Scott is a graduate of Rex Putnam High School and Linfield College, and just an outstanding young man.
And a constituent of yourself.
Yes.
And you might even consider paying him from time to time.
Well, he isn't a constituent now. He lives in McMinnville. But if you can't live in Milwaukee, McMinnville's the next best place. Okay. Any questions? Okay. I think what I'm going to do on that one, I'm going to move to a work session on it, okay? Open a close the public hearing on Senate Concurrent Resolution 9. Open a work session on Senate Concurrent Resolution Number 9.
Move the bill to
Senate Concurrent. Move Senate Concurrent Resolution Number 9 to floor with repass recommendation. Discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Lynn.
Aye.
Senator Hill.
Aye.
Senator
Aye. Motion passes. Senate Concurrent Resolution Number 9 will be sent to the floor with recommendation. Closing the work session on Senate Concurrent Resolution Number 9, I'll carry the bill. Going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill Number 904. Senator Lim.
Thank you.
Yes. And I can cut senators off pretty fast, too.
Mr. Chair, yes, I'm bringing a couple of members.
Yes, you may.
From
you bet. You bet. Yes, we have them. Kai Hong Tsar, Scott Rohr, Ron Schubert, and Dave Wolf.
Yeah, I will be very brief. For the record, my name is John Lim, State Senator from District 11. Sitting with me here, Mr. Che, he's a good friend of mine. He's known as the godfather of the Korean martial arts, Taekwondo in the Portland area. Next gentleman I just met today, well, I'm sure they will introduce themselves later, but they are the leaders in this martial arts area. I introduced Senate Bill 904 out of a chief concern for promotion, health, and safety, especially young people in this martial art area. By the way, I have a black belt, a fourth degree.
Okay, you take as much time as you want, Sam.
But you don't have to be afraid of it. It's an only honorary degree given by Mr. Chair. Okay. I believe that we have a lot of problems in our area, in not only in our state, even the Denver, the Colorado area, that Middleton, you know, I don't have to explain those things. We need to control young people in one way or another. I believe this martial art will help them promote, give them self-esteem, give them discipline, and when they go to martial arts school, they study better, they obey, and this is, martial art is not something about violence. It is something about self-defense and self-esteem. Out of that, I created, introduced legislation 904, creating the commission appointed by the governor. In our state, we have more than 200, close to 300 martial arts that the academy in our state. It is unregulated. We don't know who controls it. They give out the black belt to anyone they want, like me. And so, somehow, when they organize it, I think it will be good for the state, for the students, and so in such a manner. And so, this is a concern of health and safety, and so ask that, with that, I will let introduce that yourself to from the far left over there. Usually the procedure here, state your name, what you are, and then you can say about this Senate 904.
My name is Ron Schubert. I own a Martial Arts Fitness Center in Gresham, Oregon. I have since 1992. With all due respect to Senator Lim, I think his ideas are very admirable. However, I'm not sure legislation is what this industry needs. I am all for educating the general public on martial arts. I think it does everything he says it does and more. I'm not sure we need the state to legislate how to run our schools. Just due to the fact that there's a wide number of martial arts schools out there and a vast number of different styles. Each one has their own certification methods. To bring them under one governing body would be a almost impossible task, in my opinion, between Taekwondo, Kung Fu, Karate. The last count in China, there were 532 forms of Kung Fu being practiced as of last year. I'm not sure how you'd regulate that many number of styles.
You have reservations about the bill.
I have some reservations about the bill, yes.
Okay.
I do agree with some of the points, most definitely. But I have some reservations in terms of the bill.
Okay. Yes, Senator. Do you think that the people who are involved in these facilities would be willing to pay a fee to finance the operation of this? There's going to be some costs involved, especially if it does any kind of regulation or certification. And so normally such boards operate on fees. They're not a general fund expense. Do you think people would be willing to do that in each of these facilities?
As a small business owner myself, personally I call them fee to death. And I'm sure most of the other small businesses would feel the same. I personally would not support that.
Okay. I think we have your answer on that one. Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Yes. Mr. Wolf. My name is Dave Wolf. I have a martial arts school here in Salem on State Street, and I've been open since 1982, and I also teach the martial arts at Schenectady Community College, and I've been there for around 20 years also. I probably concur that I have some reservations. I think that when you start to regulate the martial arts, I kind of look at it as the martial arts as being math. And then you have trigonometry, geometry, calculus, and every one of those are different systems or styles or different denominations and religions, and to tell someone how to train, not train, is a very difficult thing to do. However, I do feel there is a need for some safety issues that could arise, such as let's say every instructor needs to have a CPR card or a first aid card. There needs to be some responsible measures taken by some of the other school owners. In answer to Senator Troyer's question, I don't think that very many schools would, because they're from so many different diverse systems that the formation of it would not necessarily benefit them. I'm all for paying a fee if it directs my my school and my profession in a general direction.
This advisory committee is going to help promote martial arts.
And
your fee would help to do that. Would you want to pay it to do that?
Depending upon how it promotes it. If regulation is promoting, then I don't see how that promotes it. If I saw a way in which in the bill it promoted it, I'm all for promoting the martial arts. I would pay a fee to promote. It's like advertising. Yes, I would. But to regulate specific things, I would probably say no. I have my reservation.
Okay. Well, thank you. I think I'm going to move on to you, Mr. Saying your name right, Tyrone.
I've been since 1972 in Portland area, specifically I'm teaching at Portland State University and Lewis and Clark and Mount Hood and the PCC Suburban Harbor College program. That's today very popular Taekwondo martial art is whole world sports martial art, and especially next year, 2000 Sydney Olympic, officially four medal Taekwondo martial art. We have about 300 different martial arts in the United States, but only one Taekwondo system except the world game and four medal Olympic items. I understand I've been here in 1972, presently almost 25 years, attached as martial art. Many people understand martial art just like a beat him up, kick him up, looks like a bad guy, but not really that bad guy. Most we emphasize developing good attitude character. That's how we show. Martial art is not working up to the physically, most mentally. How a young generation control himself and way of the drugging, more respect to parents, more respect to family, responsible himself. Then also respect to himself, develop himself to kids. Then also, our organization, many different organizations, but we are a non-profit organization. That's on the United States Olympic Committee. We call the United States Taekwondo Union. That is, each state have a governing body. Then, which is a student, I mean, a martial arts student who representable me to the national. Then national is one of them representable United States team.
Do you feel we need an advisory committee?
Well, it depends on what kind of advisors grooming. But my opinion, yes, more we control, we have 250-round schools. Some schools not qualified to help the kids, students. Hmm. Some instructors are really qualified. Therefore, I like more Oregon State, there are quality martial arts group. Then maybe state help with something developing quality and martial art is a martial art. I'm not discrimination, but how instructor qualified that more control, safety, help the audience here.
Senator Lim, any last word you
want to say? My comment is that my family cannot try to regulate. It's up to the industry. If they want to form some kind of an advisory group, it's fine with me. If they don't want it, then I have no willing to push for it. So we are going to get the leaders get together and find out the conclusion.
Right. Well, thank you very much. Was there anyone else who wanted to testify on this today? Okay. Thank you, folks, very much for being here. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 904 and open a public hearing on I'm going to open a hearing on Senate Bill 479.
Oh, just a second.
But, oh. Yes.
So I have to leave this in for the doctor. I was wondering if you could allow me, it won't change the outcome, if I could vote on that second bill you voted on.
Oh, yes. On Scott's version?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. I'm going to, I'm going to close the public hearing on 479, open the work session on Senate Concurrent Resolution 9. Senator Shannon would like to vote on Senate Concurrent Resolution.
Okay.
Senator votes aye.
Thank you, Senator.
And closing the work session on Senate Concurrent Resolution 9, reopening the public hearing, and I think we're going to try to do all three.
Four.
Mm-hmm. Four bills. Yeah. Okay, we're opening public hearing on Senate Bill 479, Senate Bill 1071, Senate Bill 1072, and Senate Bill 1073. Senator Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What I've asked to happen is that I just staff here to expedite things, and I think most of the people that are testifying the bill have moved to the front row. I ask that they do that or to the front of the chamber. I'm going to introduce each one of these real quick. I'll do that and then just let them each take a minute or so. They come from various homeless advocacy groups and religious organizations and so on. Okay?
Senator, may I comment? Is anyone here to testify on Senate Bill 1219? Senate Bill 1219. We will not hold a public hearing on that. It'll be after 4 o'clock. Meet the legal time limit. So I wanted to announce that. Somebody, if somebody's waiting, it will be after 4 o'clock. Okay, Senator, go ahead.
Okay, Senate Bill 479 would give churches, synagogues, and so on, various kinds of houses of faith, the right to allow individuals to camp on their property. If you read that bill carefully, it just says that, and in fact, we have an amendment to it, and if you just read the amendment, the dash one into it, it would say a political subdivision in this state may allow churches, synagogues, and similar religious institutions to offer overnight camping space on institutional property. It limits them to like 3 vehicles a night or less. The church or the synagogue would have to provide a bathroom, trash disposal facilities, and so on. The reason that we're using may instead of must is because of the issue of local control. We believe in local control, unless it has to do with pesticides. Mm-hmm. Excuse me, that's not part of the testimony.
Just being a wise guy here.
Nope. No political commentary.
No political commentary is intended. Actually, seriously, when I looked at this at first, I thought to myself, a municipality ought to allow a church or a synagogue to have homeless people in their parking lot if they want to, you know. And I kind of lean toward must. But when you think about the issue of local control, using the word may still does help. And Jerry Beverly can talk about that a little bit more a little bit later. Can I move to 1071?
Yes.
Okay. Have I made this one clear enough?
By making it permissive, do you need the bill? Can't they do this already?
They cannot do it already, and Jerry would be glad to talk to that in a moment. Is that okay? Okay. The next one, a few years ago, I actually got through the House and the Senate a bill that requires police to put up a 24-hour notice if they are going to sweep away a homeless camp. You know, under a bridge or something on public property. Police were supposed to put up a 24-hour notice, and at the same time, the social worker in me, the preacher in me, wanted the police to contact a local social service agency so that people that are homeless actually get some help. Okay? Because when they're in crisis, when they know that their little tent or their sleeping bag or anything is going to get picked up, thrown in the trash, they have a chance both to pick it up, but if a social service person from a social service agency went in there, they might respond and might get some help. The problem is that the police have, I think, kind of maybe misinterpreted this law a little bit, because when they go to post a site saying that they're giving the 24-hour notice, but in addition to posting it, they are actually giving $100 citations to homeless people that are there at the time.
And that seems to be kind of a distortion of the legislative intent when we passed this law. Okay? And I think everybody in this room was either in the House or the Senate at the time that that became a law. We wanted the 24-hour, and I notice as a fairness thing to individuals, putting up a 24-hour notice and giving people a ticket at the same time doesn't make sense. And that's why this bill is here.
Not the intent of the original bill.
I don't think it was the intent that police go in and cite people. Now, we have some questions about the language, and can I just read on the first page here, and you decide, on line 7, 8, and 9, the way it reads right now. It says, prior to removing homeless individuals from an established camping site, issuing a citation to a homeless individual for trespassing on public property, or issuing a citation to a homeless individual for camping on public property, law enforcement officials shall post a notice written in English and Spanish 24 hours in advance. Now, the city of Portland, speaking through one of their lobbyists, suggested that the language be slightly different. I don't quite see the difference, but just listen to the language for a minute. Can I read it again?
Mm-hmm.
The bold material would be removed, and it would read this way. Prior to removing homeless individuals from an established camping site, and prior to issuing a citation for camping on public property or for trespassing, law enforcement officials, back to the regular type, law enforcement officials shall post notice written in English and Spanish 24 hours in advance.
The second one's clearer, I think.
It's shorter, and it may be clearer.
Does it leave out something you want in?
I don't think it leaves anything out, and if you wish we can draft it, you can see the difference between the two. This was written by the attorney's legal counsel, and this was written by a mere lobbyist. So, you know, whether you want the attorney's or whether you want, you know, the lobbyist version, as long as it gets to the same point where we don't want people, you know, finding people at the same time as we have a public notice.
The simultaneous, we'll say that for the racing discussion.
Right, that's simultaneous. Yeah, simultaneous. Yeah, that's another bill. And I don't promote those bills, incidentally.
Right.
In my ministry, Presbyterians may promote the horses and the dogs, but not us men. On to 72.
Still won't be a free Methodist. It sounds cheaper.
Well, I tell you, those Presbyterians cost money. Number 1072, I'm losing my notes. I'm racing around here.
Sounds like a typical Sunday morning.
You want me to take up the collection next? 1072 prohibits municipalities and counties from removing homeless individuals from public property under specific conditions. And they cannot remove an individual from a campsite if, one, adequate shelter space isn't available, two, the individual is not willing to move for personal reasons such as separation from family, fear of bodily injury, or fear of loss of property. I bring this one forward because I think it'll be an interesting public discussion. I'm going to move on and let some of the witnesses testify on that one. 1073, likewise, is a bill that, you know, from my experience as a pastor and one trying to take care of homeless in the inner city makes sense. This one would prohibit a municipality or county government from fining homeless individuals for trespassing or camping on public property. The problem with it is that it does eliminate the anti-camping ordinance in a city like Portland, and that kind of gets, you know, even city commissioners upset a little bit with me. But when you stop and think about it, is it productive to take somebody who's so poor that they're homeless and fine them for being homeless, which doesn't exactly help them get money together to take care of being homeless, if you get the drift? Anyway, those are the four bills. I really hope that we can handle a couple of them and maybe even move on.
Okay, thank you, Senator. We want to call on some of the witnesses.
And, yeah.
Well, else we have Jerry, if Jerry Nellen has signed up, if you could. Again, I'm going to ask everyone to be very, very brief. so we know where you stand on the issue and any highlights that we need to know.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jerry Beaverland. I'm here today representing Oregon Coalition.
Hold on, Dan Murphy.
Housing and Homelessness. And my written testimony is not much different than the letter I sent to all members of the committee a couple of days ago in anticipation of this hearing. Essentially, Senator Shields explained the bill. A couple of things that I think need to be noted is that, first of all, the May issue in Senator Trost's question is, the reason you still need the bill is this gets us by without a lot of complications dealing with zoning, conditional use permits, all kinds of other things. So it really just short-circuits the process, and so it does some really good. Also note that we don't anticipate this as a permanent solution. We're not expecting people to camp in a church parking lot for any length of time at all. It's just a couple of days, or we can get them plugged into the social service system and deal with their problems and move them into some kind of transitional housing. But it gives them a safe, secure place to do it, because when you've got them on the streets going from parking lot to vacant lot to God knows where, then it's almost impossible to settle that situation. They've done it in Eugene. It works very well. Also would note, most of the campers are families. And so, as I explained to one person, the people who will be in the parking lot during the week aren't much different than will be in the parking lot on Sunday. Mm-hmm. Essentially the same folks.
Mm-hmm.
It's voluntary on the church's part. We do not anticipate that people will just pull into a parking lot and say, here I am, I want to park here. Churches have to put together. There is a letter that was delivered to you as part of the record from the city of Eugene.
We have done it. We will enter that in
the
record.
I decided because they've done it, it works very well. The system they use is what we anticipate happening is the churches who wish to do that will get the permission, then work with a social service agency who will then issue the permit or make arrangements for them to go to the church parking lot and park. It's not a question somebody's going to cruise around looking for a parking lot and just pull in. So with that,
thank you,
Mr. Chair. The point of the letter is also that before they had the ordinance in Eugene, they had to go through a lot of conditional use permit kind of stuff that's been short circuited. Now that they have this kind of ordinance, and that's what the bill would do, statewide.
So with that, we would ask, after this gets through, that you accept the dash ones and move to the floor.
Yes. My question is that if Eugene is able to do it without this law, can any city do it?
They did it.
If the church is really wanted it?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Chan, they could. Eugene did it by doing a local ordinance, and what you'd have to do is go by jurisdiction to jurisdiction to jurisdiction and go through the lengthy process of dealing with an ordinance. And what we're just trying to do is make it easy and clean for everybody. And remind you that the municipalities would still have the option of saying no if they still chose.
But they just wouldn't have to go through the whole ordinance process.
Just a second. My concern is that if the neighbors of the church said, you know, we like the next church, but this isn't what we had in mind, then the church can say we have the state law.
Mr. Chairman, yes. Senator Shannon, the city, the jurisdiction, city or county, whatever, can still say no. And if you don't have anything, I seem to be the church is the most community-based organization. I would find it hard to believe that if the neighbors and the church got into a spat over this, that the church would persist over the neighborhood. But nevertheless, if it did, they could still go back to the city or county and have the approval removed.
This is enabling.
That's great.
Okay. Ellen.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Ellen Lowe. I direct public policy for Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon, and I'm here today to support 479 with the amendments. And one of the things maybe that I can add, I served a couple of terms on a city planning commission, and I do know that if indeed there were some conflict with the neighborhood, that there certainly are avenues for that to be expressed. So, and the other is that in my experience with working with congregations, and particularly out in some of the rural areas, and this is in eastern Oregon and in central Oregon, where sometimes people get stranded, it's often the sheriff's office or the local police are the ones that will contact the local congregation and arrange for space or shelter. And so it's very much the custom of congregations to work with local social service agencies, and particularly in the rural areas, I would suggest with the local police or sheriff's office.
Okay, thank you, Annie. Yes, John.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Dan Murphy. I'm the president of the Oregon.
Excuse me. Go ahead.
I'm the president of the Oregon Coalition on Housing and Homelessness, and I'm just here to let you know that the membership of the coalition, the board of directors, supports this bill as amended.
How about the other bills that we're discussing?
I'm only here to speak for 4 seconds.
Okay, fine. Thank you. All right.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, for the coalition, note that 2 sessions ago, when we were then known as Oregon Shelter Network, we were the requesters of the bill that put in the 24-hour sweep notice legislation. So we support Senator Shields' efforts to straighten those things out.
Okay. Okay, folks, thank you.
Mr. Chair, Ellen Lowe again, may I also say that we do endorse Senator Shields' efforts to really bring into reality what all of us intended.
Okay. Thank you very much. Okay, Chuck, is it Chuck Curry? Okay, Chuck. By the way, if you're going to, the order I'm going in, Mickey Ryan, Karen Lenore, Genevieve Nelson, Bill Boy John, Mo Simmons, Cindy Greeny. I'm going to go in that order. If you have things, invite 3 of you to come on up. And let's keep 3 up here at all times. And if you have something to hand out, give it to her as you come up to the pier. We can keep it moving. Okay? Chuck?
Mr. Chairman, my name is Chuck Curry. I serve as the coordinator of EMO's Interfaith Homeless and Housing Coalition and as the director of community outreach at First United Methodist Church in Portland. Our church operates the Goose Hollow Family Shelter, which is Portland's largest winter shelter for homeless families. And I'm here to ask you to support all 4 of the bills. I'll let you read my testimony so that I can be briefer, but there's a couple things I'd like to point out. Earlier last year, our church funded a study, a statewide study on civil rights and homelessness in Oregon, and some of the findings in that report were disturbing. They came from interviews with 253 homeless Oregonians in a series of meetings and conversations with local and national advocates. 61% of the people that we surveyed reported that the police had without provocation, randomly stopped them on the street. 81% of the people that we had surveyed said they had been cited under an anti-camping ordinance for trespassing or excluded from the park. What we have essentially done is made homelessness illegal through the enforcement of different laws that simply punish people because of their economic status. The bill before you now will help us guarantee that people are no longer arrested and or fined because they are only homeless. We would never tolerate discrimination of this sort because of color, class, or gender, and we should not tolerate it based on income alone. Having said that, I have to admit that this is a frustrating issue to many people. I would love it if you could, in fact, pass a bill that would outlaw homelessness for all. But to do that, you would also have to pass a bill that would provide decent, safe, affordable housing for all Oregonians. And I would just like to close by saying that I appreciate Senator Shields and the committee's full commitment to local control of these types of issues for housing.
Thank you very much, Chuck. Nikki Ryan.
Good afternoon.
Next person on up, Karen.
My name is Nikki Ryan, and I'm an attorney with Legal Aid Services of Oregon in the Multnomah County office. I've represented low-income Oregonians in housing matters for 20 years, and during the last 5 years, I've represented numerous people who've received citations for violation of the camping ordinance. I'm lucky enough to have a couple of those people that you'll be hearing from today, but I want to tell you that the characteristics around those people vary greatly. Some of them work. Some have disabilities. Some are looking for work. They might have a steady income. They might not have a steady income. Some people may have disabilities so severe that they're not able to access social and financial services that are available to them. They may have a family or family-like support system consisting of husbands, wives, partners, friends, children, pets. They may have no family or support system. They're, in other words, just like us. I really believe after doing this work this time that they would all choose to live inside if they could find housing that was affordable, stable, and allowed them to live with their families. But it really just isn't available right now. As I also said, I believe that a characteristic they share is that many of them have been abused or neglected as children, which makes them fearful of things like a social service system and skeptical about getting help. And then what happens when they try to get help is they're faced with the issues that are dealt with in my attachment. The first one talks about the emergency shelter system available for single adults in Portland. And as you'll see, every publicly funded shelter says waiting list, waiting list, waiting list. There are three private shelters which have restrictions. Closed Sundays, closed Mondays, 7 day, seven night maximum, closed during the summer. There is not shelter space. And this is for single adults, and I think Senator Shields is quite familiar. It is even worse for families. A homeless person also has to perform duties just to be on a waiting list. They have to call in every day. They have to check in. There's all kinds of barriers. I'm sure you're probably familiar with the waiting list for subsidized housing. In Multnomah County, we have usually 3,000 people on the public housing waiting list. We have thousands on the Section 8 waiting list that only opens for a week every couple of years. And then also, I'm sure you're familiar with the high cost of housing in Portland. I have apartment vacancy listing, which shows the cheapest one-bedroom is $395 and the average is $500. The last attachment is a very nice chart that was done by the City of Portland, as a matter of fact, talking about what housing is affordable. And you'll see that to afford that $500 average one-bedroom, a three-person family would have to be making $19,200 simply to afford a $480 rent. So for anyone, for most of these people on this list, often working full-time at minimum wage or even above, you know, there is no housing affordable for them in Portland. The other issue is whether the anti-camping ordinances are constitutional at all when the shelter is not being provided. There have been cases that found that it is not legal, it's not constitutional to penalize people by putting citations on them when you're not providing shelter and they have no choice.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Sorry if we go ahead. Karen Lenore.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'd like to begin by thanking you for this opportunity to testify in support of Senate Bills 1071, 72, 73, and 470. My name is Karen Lenore, and I'm here representing the community and my community's own student connection. We're based in Portland, Old Town, and our mission is to end the suffering caused by hunger and poverty through economic analysis, through concrete action, and an enlightened fellowship which empowers everyone. We've been working against the anti-camping ordinance.
Karen, I'm going to ask you, we have this, if you would just highlight a couple points for us, then we can move.
We'd like to say that we have a history, and you can see in there, of trying to work with our local leaders and helping them to understand the absurdity and cruelty of the anti-camping ordinance. We'd like to say that people generally fall into two camps, that they heartfully their decisions or they're ruled by their mind. The ordinance, as it's currently being enforced, suggests that there must be a third camp because its practice and its effects could not appeal to either a heart or a mind. I'll let you read the quote for yourself from the person under the bridge. And I would like to agree with Senator Shields that ORS 203.077 through .081 require that individuals be given a 24-hour notice before they're removed from a campsite, and that some law enforcement officials are interpreting the city policy to mean that they may simultaneously ticket as well as giving the 24-hour notice. So we feel this clearly disregards the intention as that's already been stated.
Okay.
We'd like people to understand and bear in mind that these violations carry the possible punishment of a $100 fine, 30 days imprisonment, or both. And an habitual offender or someone who engages in chronic may receive a misdemeanor charge after only a second ticket. Once that is on their record, their opportunity for permanent housing decreases substantially. Mm-hmm. The anti-camping ordinance assumes that an individual is choosing to sleep on public property. Yet if we look at the statistics available to us through Multnomah County, people who are homeless actually do not have so many choices. The Multnomah County shelter counts, as you may already know, are done every 6 months. Agencies throughout the area agree on one particular night to count those people requesting shelter, including those who are housed and those who are turned away. It doesn't begin to capture the vast amount of people who are unable to reach the facilities, are unable to use phones to be able to call in and request help. It doesn't include those who are no longer requesting shelter because they're discouraged by the waiting list that takes weeks, sometimes months, to move through.
Karen, I think these numbers are very helpful to us, too.
Okay.
I think we have that.
Okay.
Is that?
At any rate, I'll let you look at the table and the gap that indicates that we are not keeping pace with the need. And I would just like you to recognize that we are not advocates of homelessness in support of this. We are advocates of and for the homeless people. And we would like to continue to work for real solutions that promote affordable housing and to continue to advocate for adequate shelter. And we applaud your efforts to do the same. Until our state is successful in these goals, these bills ensure that we do not criminalize poverty, that as a society we don't facilitate the downward spiral for people who truly need and deserve shelter.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that. Anything else? By the way, Bill, John, and Mo Simmons should be moving forward, and Cindy Greeny. Go ahead.
I'm Jenny Nelson. I'm the co-founder and current executive director of Sisters of the Road Cafe in Portland, Oregon. And the cafe supports Senate Bill 1073. I would like to read my first paragraph and then highlight the other two that you have in front of you. We've been opposed to Portland, Oregon's anti-camping ordinance since its inception. Along with the Burnside Community Council, we originally filed a suit against the city. We argued then, and we argue now, that the ordinance doesn't address the root causes of sleeping under a bridge, wages that don't keep up with the cost of living and the astonishing loss and lack of vital low-income housing. That first anti-camping ordinance went into effect on the 4th of July, 1981, was overturned in the courtroom that same year, and reintroduced and adopted by the City Council in 1982. We have lived with this ordinance for 17 years, and it doesn't recognize what over almost two decades of enforcement has done to a people. It has rendered them invisible. It has made them criminals because they cannot afford a place to sleep or cannot find an available bed in a shelter. What follows in the rest of my testimony is Sisters' collaboration with Visions in Action and the attempts we have made historically for the last 4.5 years to bring this issue to bear. And my last point is to say that I would urge us to take a look at that, the fact that what we pay for the cost of ticketing homeless campers, sweeping their camps, and the attendant court and legal fees, to compare those costs with the amount of money it takes to join a Center for Involvement, which is in Portland, Oregon, to transition a person from their campsite into permanent housing, including the outreach worker's salary and benefits plus outreach costs. The per person amount is $675.
Thank you very much. Okay. Bill Boyd.
Yeah. My name is Bill Boyd, and I'm representing an agency called JOIN, Center for Involvement.
Okay, I'm sorry. All right.
Okay. JOIN provides advocacy and outreach and support for people who are living on the streets in Portland, and I and the organization JOIN are in support of all four bills. I won't read through my whole testimony. I'll keep it brief. But I do want to highlight a couple of the points that I had written. Our primary goal, or the reason why we're in existence, is to support the efforts of people who are living on the streets transition into permanent housing. We've had quite a bit of success at that, and the way we have success is by overcoming a lot of the barriers that are institutionalized against people who are currently homeless in the city of Portland. I think Mickey Ryan's testimony highlighted all those, so I won't repeat that. The current anti-camping ordinance as it exists is an additional barrier by criminalizing having no place else to go. The final page of my testimony is titled "The Criminalization of Homelessness." It describes a gentleman named Luke who had contact with JOIN and how his inability to find work in a timely manner and find a place to live led him to getting a ticket for camping. He didn't make his court date for various reasons, and through the whole situation, a warrant was issued for him, and he ended up with a felony charge, which is now permanently on his record. And his only crime, so to speak, was not having a place to go. And the bill, certainly as they are written, will not solve homelessness, but they will help overcome the barriers that do keep people on the streets, and we would encourage and support the passage of
Thank you very much, Bill.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
As a couple other people are coming up.
Yes. Mo Simmons, Cindy Greeny, and Christina Tolendo, and David Evans.
Mr. Chair, as they're coming up, I wanted to make a couple comments. number one, advocates, a lot of advocates contacted my office, and I do want you to know that I have a feeling that we probably could have filled the room with advocates, and I did what I could to have just a set number of people come, and I appreciate you allowing them to speak. I know some of them look stressed because they're trying to say 10 times as much as I have.
I'm feeling frustrated too, but we have, at 4:30, the Senate, we have the Joint Senate House meeting on the day of acknowledgement, and I want to be sure we get there, and I've got to be sure I get through about how many more bills?
A bunch.
Mo?
Yes, my name's Mo Simmons.
All right.
I'm a former homeless camper. I'm fortunate enough to have shelter at this time, but I need the state to get it. Well, Mr. Chairman, committee members, I'm speaking with you today concerning the ticketing of homeless campers. I feel that the persecution and prosecution of the homeless is inhumane. People sleeping outdoors have enough problems without the added burden of being rousted by the authorities. There are many varied reasons why people end up homeless. Not all of the homeless are criminals, drunkards, or addicts. They are human beings facing and surviving extreme circumstances, oftentimes facing physical acts of violence, theft of property, and the uncertainty of knowing where they shall lay their heads down for the night. Most shelters are full with long waiting lists. Affordable housing for low-income families and individuals is far below the need of those who would benefit. The passing of these bills would be a small step toward eradicating the miasma of issues surrounding homelessness. I believe that people with large minds and large hearts working in concert may solve large problems for the well-being of all concerned.
Thank you very much, Will. Very, very well said. Okay. Cindy Greeny.
Hi. Hello. I'm Cindy Greeny, and I'm here to part with Joy. I'm a single white female, and I want to make it short and sweet without my dogs. I would prefer having a gun. I prefer to have my guns over a dog, and my dogs over a gun. And there is no accurate shelter for me. I can't tie my dogs up to a meter. And I know there's 30, 40 people that I stay with at St. Francis that we all have dogs and animals, and they're just not, you know, an added commodity. A lot of people will tell me that if I can afford a dog, I can afford a place to live. Well, that's not the case. I much rather see myself with my dog than with an AK-47. And it's just not safe out there. And if there's proper shelter and there's proper, you know, protection for my dogs, you know, it would make my life a lot easier. And these bills that are before you would make my life a lot easier, too, if I didn't have to be rostered at 2 in the morning and told that I was an illegal camper and could go to jail and my dogs could be put to death.
No, we learn something new every day.
I just wanted to speak up for my dogs and speak up for the white people.
I should have had you go up with the animal control people.
Well, I was just totally on that.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay?
Thank you very much.
You bet. Christina. You're next, and David Adams, Pulido, is it Pulido?
Pulido,
okay, I see, and David Adams, okay,
right here,
okay, and again, if you just highlight what you're going to say, so I can,
you're here to speak about, okay, I'm not going to go over any of this, because you got a copy of it, but, about the $100 fine, we were issued $150 fine. And when we were issued these citations, I asked the officer, what constitutes camping? And the officers, we were living in a car, which I bought the car to help us move out of a place in which the landlord refused rent, which means we only had a limited time before we had to get out. Just things in a wheelchair. There's hardly no housing for it. If you got bad credit, lived in slumlords for 4 years, you're sitting there totally lying about your rent history. The officer just said you can't sleep in your car, and when I asked him, well, what's the difference between a distressed motorist with a broken down car? And he turned around and gave me a catch-22 situation, which I weigh 140 pounds.
I was not supposed to be driving myself because I was suspended for driving while uninsured. I never hit nobody. She thinks if I taxi cab driver, with, and the taxi cab company never paid a dime. It just appalls of what the heck is going on.
It just kind of keeps.
I get $3.05 less than federal minimum wage, and I get paid by the state because I'm a health care provider. There's no shelters on for anybody in a wheelchair.
Well, thank you for providing this. This is very helpful. I think it catches the eye of the committee members. I'm sure that will be read. Anything else you'd like to say?
I would just like to say that I give all these people a lot of credit for being here, and I just hope that something can be done. I mean, I'm lucky enough to be in an apartment now, but I will where some of these people are. And
you've been there.
I've been there.
Sharon or Mickey.
Yeah.
We would still be homeless, and we'd be in jail by then.
And I thank you for listening to us.
Thank you very much. We really appreciate you being here. Okay, I'm looking quickly here. We have Derek Kendall. Now, as I look at the list, I believe I will have given everyone an opportunity to speak. Is that correct? Okay, Doug?
Chair Duncan, members of the committee, good afternoon. Doug Tindall, maintenance engineer from Oregon Department of Transportation. We have just a small concern with only Senate Bill 1072. We don't make it a habit of, as part of our routine business, is not to trying to serve homeless people. There's been discussion about 24 hours, the ODOT rules, if you're on ODOT, stay right away before we move into attempt to clean up a homeless camp. We get 10 days notice. We store all of the any possessions that we get for 30 days and allow people to come get them. So we are trying to not only, and those that policy, that procedure has been on the books prior to the passage of the 24 hour. Issue. Our concern with Senate Bill 1072 is that we often, when we do have to go in and do a cleanup under an ODOT bridge or on ODOT property, we often work with local law enforcement, and this would appear to limit our ability to work with local law enforcement to address a safety situation when they arrive. And that's all I have.
May I suggest that you touch base with Senator Shields about your concern?
Absolutely, yes.
Answering that you addressed.
Senator,
could you do that later?
I'd be happy to. Okay. In fact, I apologize for not doing that before.
Okay. You do that once, yes.
Yeah, I'd like to ask him to together with my staff.
Okay.
Okay.
Great. Do that right now. Okay. All right. We want to thank all you folks, because I know the difficulties of taking time away and getting here, and just I realize it's time consuming, and I regret that we rushed you and you didn't feel like you had the time to tell your full story. You happen to be meeting today with a rather sympathetic committee dealing with the concerns that you have. You never can say, I haven't walked in your shoes, so I can't say I really understand, but I can empathize with you. So I think we'll be looking at some of these things, see what we can do, and we'll be in touch with you on that.
And I think on that center, okay. No.
Yeah, I know you want to close the hearing, but I heard some of you say that you kind of like that amendment on 1071. Senator Crow, in fact, said so.
Mm-hmm.
If it's okay with you, I will get that amendment drafted.
Yes.
Okay? I mean, it's just one sentence. It shouldn't take legislative council long so that we can bring that back next week.
Next week, we'll bring this back. Okay, at this point, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 479, 1071, 1072, and 1073. I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 276, and I'm going to close the public hearing on 276. This is just to get this on the record, folks. This is the one where we may need to split the PERS. And the other, I just don't want to lose that PRS bill, okay? I'm now going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 567. And then close it, too? And I'm going to close the public hearing on 567 at this point, okay? I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1114. and close it. Mm-hmm. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1114. I'm going to open the hearing on Senate Bill 1142. Close the hearing on Senate Bill 1142. I tell you, we can really move when we have to, can't we? I'm going to open public hearing on Senate Joint Resolution 24. And I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Joint Resolution 24. I'm now going to open the public hearing on Senate Bill 1219, and I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1219. Diane, I'm going to reopen the public hearing briefly, just to hear a report on 1285.
Thank you, Chair Duncan. This is Diane Mill, Director of Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, and also Henry Miggins is with me. The interested parties have all met. We have decided that this is a topic that's going to take quite a bit more discussion, especially as we deal with the fiscal impact. We have agreed that we will work together during the session to see, between sessions, to see if we can come up with a solution and be back at the next session, hopefully with some answers and resolution. I think we should be able to. It's just, it's a money issue, but there are some options that we can look at. So we will work together.
Hank Megan. We have some concerns about the money issues, about where the money goes and how it goes, and doing the answer session, we're going to work at finding out where that money is and how we can use it. We're also going to be looking at the mechanics of how we get the training we need certified and verified by the FSC. Yes.
Okay, I'm glad you folks went off and did that. All right. I think I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1285, and I'm going to open a work session on 1285.
Chair, I move that we table House Bill 1285.
The move that we then, no discussion, clerk will call the roll. The move, Senator Trillis, move that we table Senate Bill 1285.
Senator Lynch?
Aye.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Senator
Crowe?
Aye.
And Chair
Duncan? Aye. Senate Bill 1285 is tabled.
Vote explanation.
Yes.
I did this at the suggestion of the chair.
Me too. I've all followed him blindly.
Well, I,
on the record.
It seemed to me like the groups were working together pretty well. I see that this Senator Corcoran is here.
And we're wondering why.
Well, he had a bill in here. We did have a public hearing. No,
have
bill. We tapped it.
Great.
Hello.
I'll have some amendments to bring in. Been working with the Department of Justice. It's a child support based issue. And thank you very much.
Okay.
No,
we didn't want. No, we didn't want to do
that.
All right. I'd like to thank you, folks. This was an excellent committee today. Good job. I'm going to close the...